Hi, everyone. Welcome to Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, your host. PodcastUFO.com is an interactive website. You can go to our website and search on the top menu bar. You can find out how to be a guest yourself or interact with guests that we have. We also accept guest blogs, so please check us out at PodcastUFO.com. Today's episode with Don Schmidt is a one-of-two-part series. Today we're going to be talking mostly about the history of Roswell and a few things that I didn't know about. Our next episode, part two with Don Schmidt, is about new evidence that has been revealed at Roswell. Thank you for listening, and here's our show. Hi, everyone. I have Don Schmidt on the line with me, investigator for Roswell. I'm real excited to talk to you, Don. How are you doing?
Just fine, Martin. Pleasure to be with you.
Yes, great. So, first of all, before, you know, I do remember hearing about Roswell back in, say, the late 70s. I was in California. I hadn't heard anything about it prior to that. Can you kind of explain why that happened?
Well, I think dating back to the original second explanation, when they had the press conference in Fort Worth on July 8th of 1947, when they retracted the original announcement of the actual capture of the flying saucer, and they announced that it was nothing more than a downed weather balloon with a radar reflector kite, a Rowan target device. Mm-hmm. The press accepted that, and to ensure that it not only would explain Roswell, but they then proceeded, the military, they proceeded to put on demonstrations all over the country demonstrating these weather target devices. But the curious thing, the ironic thing, is that as they would launch them and they would go very high up into the atmosphere, yes, depending on the angle of the sun and the way it would compress the neoprene rubber balloon, that type of thing, yeah, it would take on the shape of something more elliptoid. It would look unusual to an untrained observer. But what they never accounted for, what they never explained away, was the fact that with Roswell, it was on the ground in front of you. It was something you could handle.
Hmm.
And they did the old switcheroo, and unfortunately, at least at that time, for us, the military walked on water. They had just won,
right,
you know, World War II, had saved us as far as from Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany, and whatever the government, whatever the military stated as fact, was accepted as gospel. And that did stand then as the official explanation, and as you mentioned, Martin, until the late 1970s. And at that time, the original head of the intelligence office at Roswell, Major Jesse Marcel, who was even pictured in two of the substituted weather balloon photographs,
mm-hmm,
that were published around the world, were printed around the world. Jesse Marcel was the fall guy because he had handled the real stuff. He was originally dispatched by the Roswell Army Air Field Base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, when a rancher north of Roswell by the name of W.W. MacBrazzo originally reported the find, the crash, to the Chavez County Sheriff, George Wilcox, who in turn contacted the military.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Marcel, as I described, had handled the real article. So he was dying of emphysema in the late 1970s. And he had always been told, you know, Jess, you just be a good soldier. You just do as you're told.
Mm.
And it will all come out in 5 years. It's, you know, it'll all come out. Well, 5 years. Well, it'll come out another five, 10 years, 15, 20. 30 years he waits until he's dying, and he sees that there is no chance that the truth is going to come out. So he steps forward. He comes out, and it's like, I'm dying anyway. What are they going to do to me?
Mm-hmm.
And he states on the record, and I can quote him, quote, being familiar with all materials, both foreign and domestic, I can assure you this was nothing made on this earth. Well, how more startling a proclamation and acknowledgement can a retired officer who was in charge, the first bomb unit, in charge of the atomic bomb, no less, come out and say, I handled pieces that were not manufactured here on this earth. And it's, and the other reason that it has become this self-perpetuating cover-up after all these years is as well evidence with Major Marcel. You didn't read about this in the press, did you? I didn't read about it in the press. It wasn't until the UFO investigators brought it forward. But the only publication that even touched Major Marcel's testimony was the National Enquirer.
Oh, no.
So there again, it was like the kiss of death. It was like, well, you know, nothing to worry about here because it's just going to be accepted as a tabloid story.
Right.
Nothing more.
Like perfect disinformation.
Exactly. Exactly. They couldn't have. They've always anticipated us, and it's one of the reasons that we have been so keen on going in directions they don't anticipate. We'll telegraph, we'll project activity in one area, and then while we'll focus on another area, we realize who we're dealing with.
Right.
Playing hardball with the big boys, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, if someone isn't really that familiar that happens to be listening, do you think that there were, the way the crash site and then the further crash sites together, do you believe that there were two ships involved in this?
No, I don't believe there were two ships involved at all. In fact, there's no evidence of that. In fact, when a good friend and colleague of mine, nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman, originally had proposed the possibility of a collision, I would strongly warn Stan that we have to prove one. Let's not make it ridiculous. And we know there were multiple sites. We have first-hand witnesses to multiple sites. But as in any crash, that is often the case. This was not a impact crash. This was a mid-air explosion. Whether it was due to the severe lightning storm or there was a mid-air malfunction within the craft itself, but nonetheless, about 75 miles northwest of Roswell, which, as I mentioned, was the headquarters of the first atomic bomb wing in the world. The 509th, this was where the Enola Gay, which had dropped the very first atomic bomb, the boxcar, which was the second B-29, dropping the second bomb, was also hangared at Roswell. So this was the elite. This was a composite bomb wing. They were the best pilots, the best crewmen, the best officers, doctors, nurses. They were all put there for one reason. They were in charge of the atomic bomb. And the very notion that they would misidentify something as mundane, as common as a neoprene rubber balloon with a reflector kite of wood, foil, masking tape and baling twine, it's just absolute nonsense. But nonetheless, there was a severe lightning storm late evening of July 3rd. And ranchers would describe between the thunderclaps hearing what sounded like an explosion, something else. And it was the rancher who I mentioned before, W.W. MacBrazzo, who discovers this huge debris field. And when I say huge, I'm talking 3/4 of a mile long in a fan shape, hundreds of feet wide. And there was a large piece of debris at the end of a few hundred foot long gouge, a furrow, something had a larger piece had slammed into the ground and skipped for a considerable length of high desert. And Brazel would then, with a number of young boys, discover a secondary site 2.5 miles east, southeast of the debris field, where a number of bodies were discovered. And unbeknownst to the Brazel and his neighbors, the other ranchers, there was a final impact site much closer to Roswell, about 35 miles north of town, about 5 to 6 miles off the main highway, Highway 285. And there was a pod, a capsule, like a escape hatch, where it was the shape, it was a slightly domed circular object about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. That is the description we hear over and over again. And for another reason, it fit on the back flatbed of a low boy truck when it came through town under a tarp. And that is where a number of additional bodies were found. And again, based on first-hand testimony, a survivor. We do have eyewitness testimony that there indeed was a survivor. So, but three distinct sites. The debris field, a secondary body site, whether they were sucked out by the percussion of the explosion or the decompression, who can say? And then a final impact site with the remains of a flight cabin, a capsule, a pod came down. But
did they
all
say,
related to the same incident.
Now, did have people calculated approximately how many bodies they think they saw?
Well, based on Brazel and the boys, we know there were at least two, because they always referred to bodies at the secondary site. And at the impact site, three dead, one survivor. So we're talking of a minimum of six bodies total.
Right. Right.
Now, depending on the witnesses, some may have seen two, some may have seen one. It's an area that the skeptics often, well, how come so-and-so says they only saw three bodies, and so-and-so says they saw four bodies? Again, depending on your vantage point, depending on where you were at the time. Let's just say they didn't put them all like a police lineup up against the wall and you could count at any one time.
Now, there was an archaeology students, is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And didn't one of them on her deathbed in Florida actually talk about this?
Yes. In fact, there was a nurse by the name of Marianne Gardner. And she worked at St. Petersburg Hospital. It's now Humana Hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida. And there was a cancer patient that she was assisting. And it was at the time that she was failing that she didn't have long to live. And she started talking about New Mexico. New Mexico in 1947, and she kept pointing out that she was not supposed to be there. She wasn't supposed to be there. Well, that made sense to us because, especially back at that time, young women, college age or what have you, would not have been allowed to accompany, you know, young men, young boys on field trips. Now, if you were doing any, you know, work as far as outside of the college, you know, campus, that women would occasionally be snuck in. You know, girlfriends would be brought along after, you know, the faculty wasn't aware of it. So, it you know, kind of tied into her remarks, you know, I wasn't supposed to be there. Yet she had a background based on her knowledge of what she described in geology. In other words, they were more rock hunters than they were excavators. You know, they were looking for things above ground. And she went on to describe that they stumbled, they came upon this crash. And it was, again, she described a smaller size craft, but she described the bodies, the non-human bodies. She didn't mention anything about a survivor, but nonetheless, within minutes after they had arrived, she described the military roaring onto the scene, coming into the area, and then quickly, you know, sequestering them, secluding them off to the side, and then warning them all that if they should ever say another word about this, that they faced physical repercussions, that they could get very rough. In fact, that's what this patient kept telling the nurse, that don't tell anyone, because the government can find you. That's how she put it. The government can find you.
Wow.
So based on our further investigation, we learned that Western Texas Tech, and the professor was the late William Curry Holden. We had talked to him. He was already in his 90s. And all he would say was that he was there, they were there on a field exercise, and they had seen everything, but wow. that he couldn't say more.
Huh.
Now, wow. we had outside confirmation from a doctor, an archaeologist by the name of Dr. Bertram Schwartz, who was working in the Guadalupe Mountains, just southwest of there, close to the Mexican border. And he was to have met with Professor Holden to go to attend a conference in Clovis, New Mexico. And when he was at the hotel, the Nixon Hotel in Roswell, where they were to rendezvous, there was no sign of Dr. Holden. Well, he would finally arrive that evening because, as he was told, Dr. Holden was detained at the base, at the military base, all day.
Mm.
For some undisclosed reason. So it's interesting how you plug in all these pieces and it just all comes together, contrary to trying to suggest this was a weather balloon.
Right.
Or anything else just as conventional.
Yes. You know, it's funny, if you really think about it, they release the fact that they find a disc and then they recant it and say...
5 hours later, right.
Yeah, and their rationale for recanting is that the debris was flown to Texas and it was a weather balloon. And the reason that they're covering the tracks so much is because it was part of a mogul that was secret, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a real nice try. I think the funniest part of the whole cover-up is the crash site, the crash dummies.
Yes,
I
absolutely.
Think that's kind of hysterical because they weren't even produced yet.
For 5 years later, such a project did not even exist, correct?
Yeah, that's really amazing.
And then they come up with this new mental condition known as time compression, that as we get older, we not only start to confuse the years, but also the decades. Well, I defy anybody to find anyone in World War II, any, you know, surviving participants of that war who forget, you know,
right.
where they were, even on what specific day. When one has profound events in one's lifetime, you never forget because you
Absolutely.
Relive them in your head over and over. You're constantly remembering, refreshing your memory. I don't know how old you are, Martin, but I certainly remember, for example, where I was on November 22nd of 1963.
I sure do, too. Yeah.
I was in fourth grade, I was in school, and I can tell you exactly the entire chain of events from the moment they wheeled in the TV into our classroom, and we were all glued to CBS News and Walter Cronkite, and then being released early from school and so
yes.
on, and then through the whole weekend. Now, the point is, as you mentioned, you will never forget, I will never forget. For the rest of our lives, we will know and remember exactly what transpired that entire weekend. And the point is, Martin, we weren't there. We weren't involved.
Right.
We didn't see it personally. The people at Roswell were there. And the insult to their very intelligence that they would forget, but they would somehow confuse something that extraordinary and then have difficulty in describing it to the investigators years later. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
Really is. And for the younger person out there, you know, when 9/11 happened.
9/11.
You know, Absolutely. You know exactly where you were. You know, that's
and
a
you
real
will,
impression. Yeah.
And you will for the rest of your lives.
That's right.
No doubt.
Now, I want to talk about the photos of the weather balloon.
Yes.
There was... Now, I'm sorry I don't have my facts exactly right here, but there's some gentleman in, I believe, San Francisco that has actually transcribed the note in the hand. Can you talk about that? What do you know about
yes.
that?
Yes. In fact, you're talking about Dr. David Rudiak, who's a member of our team. And Dr. Rudiak is actually working off of scans from the original negatives. The original pictures were taken by a Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter by the name of James B. Johnson. And Johnson, he had just returned back to the newspaper at the end of his shift. It was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Central Standard Time. And he was told to get right out to the base, get right out to Carswell, you know, Army Airfield, because they were bringing in the pieces of the flying saucer they had just announced, you know, 4 hours earlier over at Roswell, in that press release we were talking about at the beginning of the program. And he remembers being escorted to headquarters and then directly to General Roger Ramey's office. And General Ramey was the head of the 8th Air Force, which was the commanding unit over the 509th in Roswell. So Colonel William Blanchard's boss, the base commander of Roswell, his very boss was General Ramey over in Fort Worth, going up the chain of command. So it would make perfect sense that some of the material would immediately be sent to General Ramey's attention. Well, they were putting on a press conference, and one of the things that reporter Johnson first described to us was the pungent smell, the stench of burnt rubber. Even walking the hallway to the general's office, well, that was the weather balloon, the neoprene rubber weather balloon. And he was the only reporter allowed into, and I emphasize, the only reporter allowed to step into the general's office and then take 6 of the 7 pictures that were officially taken. A picture was taken later by the public information officer at Fort Worth, Charles A. Cashin, of the weather officer, Irving Newton, but that was taken later in the evening. But anyway, Johnson would take the pictures of the substituted weather balloon. And 2 of the pictures were of Major Marcel, which we talked about earlier. And then 2 of the shots were taken of General Ramey separately, and 2 additional shots of Ramey with his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas DeBose. Well, in the 4 shots, including Ramey, he's holding a folded piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And in 1 of the shots, the front of the paper is actually facing the camera. And back in 1990, when we originally learned that the negatives were still available at the University Library in Bentman, Texas, and we were able to get copies, we saw that by blowing up that picture, my God, there's print, there's type on this piece of paper. My God, if we could only blow this up big enough, we might be able to read it. Well, we had Dr. Richard Haynes, who was a consultant with NASA. He worked with JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Interesting, also in the San Francisco area is Dr. David Rudia. And we had him attempt to do some computer enhancement at that time. And he was able to pull out a few letters here and there, but only 1 word, and that was balloon. So for the next 10 years, it was our position that it was the weather balloon press release. That's all it was. Mm-hmm. Well, then as the programs started to improve, Photoshop and other such programs on the computer, people, and specifically Dr. David Rudiak, and once we were able to get scans, and for all intents and purposes, we have better images than even the original negatives. Hmm. Working with those scans and doing the pixel edge enhancement and peeling away as far as the layers of shadow and evening out the fold in the paper, Dr. Rudiak feels that he is able to read that telex, it's a teletype, by almost 75% of the visible verbiage that is on the document.
Amazing.
And what it says, according to Dr. Rudiak, it references, it refers in 2 locations, to the disc. And the word disc happens to be in quotes. Well, flying saucer and flying disc were just becoming part of the vernacular at that time.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is why were the two words in quotes, as though they were being qualified for some reason. In other words, it really wasn't a disc. Maybe it was a pod. Maybe it was more egg-shaped, that type of thing, because it wasn't a disc in the true sense of the very definition of the term, flying saucer. But the most profound, the most intriguing sentence of all, and it's a line that even the skeptics can't deny. It reads, ... the victims of the wreck you forwarded to blank blank at Fort Worth, Texas.
Hmm.
Now, victims of the wreck. Okay, obviously, one would not expect that there would be victims with a weather balloon mishap. Unless the balloon was pretty heavy and it came down on a few people. But,
yeah, who just happened to be in the middle of the desert.
Happened to be out in the middle of the high desert. You know, where, and I've been out there myself probably 100 times and seldom have come across anyone else. It's mm-hmm. that secluded, that isolated. But what I find also very interesting, Martin, is the fact, the use of the word victims. Now, if one does, their homework again and checks out a lot of military files, documents, and even in today's news, whenever the military references bodies, whether civilian or military, they use the word casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Civilian casualties, military casualties, they use that word, and they have
right.
since World War II. Victims, again, just like the word disc in quotes, they are distinguishing the use of that word. They are qualifying it for some reason.
Hmm.
Suggesting it may have been something else.
Mm-hmm.
So we have clearly a potential smoking gun. You have victims, you have bodies recovered in reference to the alleged recovery of a weather balloon. So it throws the onus right back onto the military. What victims? What bodies? From where?
Mm-hmm.
Explain this. And their explanation was, at the same time when they came out with the Project Mogul balloon explanation in September of 1994, this top secret balloon that was indeed part of the research we were conducting in the late 1940s, and they were launching them from White Sands Proving Ground, just 2 hours to the west of Roswell. The point I want to make is that the personnel at Roswell were totally familiar with the project. And mm-hmm. the very objective of Mogul was, in the event the Soviets were to detonate their own atomic bomb, that we would pick up the shockwave. That it was the same type of balloon, a cluster of neoprene rubber balloons with hexagonal radar reflector kites, and beneath it was an acoustic listening device, basically a microphone,
mm-hmm.
for the sole, purpose of picking up a shockwave in the upper atmosphere. Well, not only was that, as I described, Mogul comprised of the very same materials, the same conventional off-the-shelf materials that a five-year-old child would have recognized, aside from the microphone. But when the Soviets did actually detonate their first bomb in August of 1949, it was not detected by Mogul. So it was a dismal failure on top of it. We picked up radiation, higher levels of radiation in Europe, and seismic monitors picked up some aftershocks. Mogul didn't do its job. So the notion that this was such a top secret project that no one knew about it, and the Soviets, the last thing we wanted to them to know about was that we would detect their own explosion. Well, they knew about ours.
Right.
They knew exactly when we detonated our first atomic bomb in New Mexico, no less.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the project was secret, top secret. The materials, again, off the shelf, no problem.
Identifying
them for what it is.
I love the explanation of the hieroglyphics, that it was masking tape or something.
Yes.
I love that one. And, you know, the people that are skeptics are let's say, they're just far to that side. You know, as far to the side as, you know how people can be crazy, some of the Roswell people?
Oh, absolutely, Mark.
Are nuts.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
the fringe, the extremists.
Yeah.
But I always emphasize that I was a complete skeptic. You talk about hearing about Roswell in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first book that came out on the case, Roswell Incident, by the late Charles Berlitz and William Moore. When the book came out in 1980, I was such a skeptic, I never even bought the book, never even read it. In fact, in 1985, I put out a public statement, and I was a special investigator for the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek at that time out of the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. And I served also as his director of special investigations for 10 years. But I was such a skeptic on the notion that there had been a crash of any sort. I could not believe that something of that magnitude could be kept a secret for all that time. And then even in the late 80s, after Hynek had passed away, and I felt, well, I wanted to look into Roswell. I wanted to put an end to all of this legend, this myth, if I could, and thought we'd wrap this up in a single weekend. And we could not have been more wrong. But we came about it legitimately. We came about it by actually speaking with the first-hand witnesses.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about that. How many first-hand witnesses have you actually spoken with?
To date, have talked to over 150 first-hand witnesses.
Is that right?
And a total of over 600 witnesses directly or indirectly involved. Yes.
That's amazing. Now, but there's not too many of them left, right?
No. And in fact, we're presently working on 18 specific witnesses,
wow,
ranging in age from 86 to 95. Still with us.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we have pinned them down. We know what cities, where they're located, and now it's a matter of getting to them and hoping they will go on the record, as so many others have, before too late.
Right.
I'll give you an example of one of the new witnesses. His father worked for the civil service at that time. So he worked with the freight yard. And there was a freight yard just to the east of the base at Roswell. So obviously they would rail in materials, they would ship out materials, aircraft parts, you know, haul in new Jeeps, whatever, you know, equipment, you know, that were being used at the base at that time. And they were aware of the information about the crash north of town. In fact, this gentleman was aware of even the flatbed trucks that had brought in numerous loads of wreckage, and they were all going to one specific hangar, which was P3, Building 84, which is a B-29 hangar. It's still at the base, still there. We've been there many times. I was just there about 10 days ago again. And this was the one hangar, the very hangar that all the wreckage, the remains of the ship, and the very bodies themselves all transited through. This was basically the one area, the one site that was the most secure. We've talked to many of the guards, both inside and outside. We've talked to officers, personnel, pilots, crewmen, all involved with special flights originating out of that hangar. Well, anyway, getting back to this freight yard supervisor, one of the days, right after the incident, a flatbed truck with a heavy tarp proceeded coming across the tarmac from the hangar directly to the freight yard. And he was then given the assignment papers that they were going to load up the contents underneath this canvas tarp on this truck. And he observes as a piece of it falls off the truck when he sees that it's some unusual looking wreckage. Well, the first chance he gets, he kind of works his way over to the site and bends over, picks it up, and sticks it right in his pocket. And he notices that it folds right up. It's metal, but that it folds right up into his pocket. And then later, when he would take it out of his pocket and he would open it up from his hand, it would just smooth right out, would unravel, would unfold. So in other words, it was a piece of the memory material,
right,
the Holy Grail, as we often refer to it. Well, I tracked down his son, talked to his son. Father, long deceased, but anyway, he was 3 years old at the time. And his father, on his 8th birthday, would give it to him and say, this is 5 years later, and he would say, this is a piece of that weather balloon that crashed outside of Roswell. And his son, seeing, you know, its, you know, special, you know, qualities, thought, my God, I could use that in my magic act. He was becoming interested in magic. And he thought, I could use this for my finale. And he would put on little magic shows for his neighborhood friends. And at the end of the act, he would crumble up this piece of metal and toss it up into the air. And all the starry-eyed, you know, amazed little friends would watch as it would just unfold and float down to the ground.
Jeez.
And he described to me how he kept this in their little clubhouse. And one night somebody broke in, and the only thing that was taken was that piece of material.
Oh, wow.
So within a year. Well, anyway, when I asked him point blank, now, you held it. You held it right in your hands. What was it? He says, Don, I have never seen anything like it since. He says, I have no doubt it was a piece of the genuine flying saucer that crashed. My father knew it wasn't a weather balloon from the very start. All the talk, everything that he was involved with. And in fact, that's the whole point, Martin. There are four now official explanations, the first being the flying saucer, the second just being the radar reflector kite, the third in 1994, the Mogul weather balloon, Project Mogul. And the fourth one, as we talked about, the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummies, which came out in May of 1997. The point is, as I mentioned, I've talked to over 600 people directly or indirectly involved, and guess how many of them support wooden crash dummies?
Probably
not a
zero.
Not one.
Right.
Project Mogul, not a one.
Wow.
Weather balloon, not a one.
Really? Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. And the point is, even to their deathbeds, and as I mentioned before we started taping, the race with the Undertaker, as we call it, the World War II generation, the attrition rate only intensifying day by day. 1,500 a day are passing away, and we realize we're going to reach the point we'll have none of these people left. But nonetheless, even to their deathbeds, days and even hours before they die, I was there, I saw it, I held it in my hands. It was a flying saucer. And as one of the officers describing the body said, they sure weren't from Texas.
Right. Now, one of the things that the skeptics, you hear them talk about, was one of the witnesses that came forward in the beginning was they found a lot of false information. And, you know, of course, they rely on that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There have been a number of witnesses. Frank Kaufman, for example.
That's the person I'm talking about.
In fact, he was one of the principal witnesses in our second book, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, that came out in 1994, actually just before the Project Mogul press conference at the Pentagon. And I was having serious doubts about Kaufman even at that time, and more so than my co-author, Kevin Randall, to the point that I continued to make trips to visit with Kaufman and constantly trying to trip him up. And I did trip him up. In fact, I would come up with code numbers that he would give us. And I would do a Google search, and I would come up with something as simple as the number of a old Methodist hymn called Thou Wilt Comest From Above. And I would confront Kaufman with it, and he would practically fall back in his chair. And he would come back and he'd go, "You're good." Huh. Well, I was catching him.
Yeah.
And even before he would pass away, I made four separate trips to sit down with him as he was dying of cancer. And I could not get him to confess. I could not get him to actually concede much of anything, though he would admit he was wrong or that he had intentionally misled us only about certain details of the case. He never confessed to being a hoax. Well, after he would pass away, I went through his office. His wife, his widow, Juanita, allowed me to spend time in his office. And I not only pulled out desk drawers, but I reached up and under inside desk drawers. And I found a document dossier. I pulled it out, and they were all original onion skin documents. And they're all documents I recognized because they were documents that Frank had displayed to us through the years. But they were different. These were the originals. And it became quite clear that the copies that Frank was flashing around in our presence were cut and paste ups.
Really?
That he was changing, you know, even his rank, he was changing his tenure, he was changing dates, he was changing as far as crucial elements of the case, and it became quite clear that he was either, you know, intentionally trying to divert, to deceive us, and if that were the case, then he was working for somebody else. Now, I'm still not finished with Frank Kaufman as far as the investigation goes. In fact, as we wind down with actual Roswell witnesses, I fully intend on going back and finding out who the real Frank Kaufman was. And I say that because he clearly was not doing this for the publicity, for the notoriety, for even the money. Frank was originally from Brooklyn, New York. And if there's one thing that I have seen in 20 years of traveling to New Mexico, if you're from out east, if you're an outsider at all, you're kind of looked at as far as with a skewed eye.
Yeah.
Like you're a revenuer, to use that old word. You're possibly a government agent. You're there looking for trouble. You're a suit who's in town asking a lot of questions. And Frank was only in Roswell for 2 years. He was only at the base for 2 years. And he returns home. His wife is all packed to head back east. And he goes, "Honey, unpack. We're staying. I've been appointed to the Chamber of Commerce." Well, again, there's no other example of someone who just moves out to Roswell and in 2 years' time becomes a member of the Chamber of Commerce. And we went back to the original minutes when Frank was introduced to the other chamber members. And what I find also interesting is that it explains that unlike all the other chamber members, Mr. Kaufman will be paid by an outside source. Well, I'm going to find out who that outside source was. I'm going to find out who appointed Frank Kaufman to the chamber. I'm going to find out why Kaufman was on the chamber for 30 years. And I'm going to find out why he immediately latched on to us. And every time we came into town, he made sure we sat down with him, and he peppered us with questions, what we were coming up with, what we were finding as far as new witnesses. And if I didn't speak with him every month, he would call me wanting to know what was new.
Wow.
So I am leaning in the direction that Mr. Kaufman was left behind to man the cookie store, so to speak.
Right. Wow.
And as a result, he had to come up with a phony story. They can't stop us. All they can do is slow us down.
That's
right. And you come up with a lot of disinformation, and as a result, you waste a lot of time trying to confirm it. And we did.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt we wasted a lot of time on Kaufman's information. I can't deny that. But we also were the very ones who exposed Kaufman for what he was. And we will also be the ones who then determine what Kaufman's true role in the Roswell incident really was.
Yeah. So, Don, this has been great. This is part one, and you are going to join us for part two. And basically, that's going to be what's current and what's current in what you have come up with in the last few years on Roswell.
That's correct, Martin. In fact, I just spent another research trip down through New Mexico. I came back with new leads and just new information, even beyond the revised, updated version of our last book, Witness to Roswell. I can honestly say we have enough material to write another whole book, because it's a devotion, a commitment that being the proactive investigators that we are, we have to, you know, take this as far as we can. And we are continually coming up with new material, new information, and specifically new witnesses who are all stating it did happen, it's true, and we are not alone.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Don. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, Mark. Look forward to the next time.
All right. Take care now.
You too. Thank you.